phonology. It's, and correct me if I'm wrong in this definition, but it's a study of the timed events in nature, the phenomena, you might say, I guess is the root there, and how that might be affected by different things, including climate change going forward.
Yeah, that's right. I guess if you go back far enough, long before recorded history, people were interested in the timing of seasonal events, whether it was the arrival of a new game species on the scene or the beginning of the growing season. And so this science, before it was given the name of phenology, has long been important for human well-being. And there are some long-term studies of phenology. Actually, the longest running study that I'm aware of is one in Japan, where they've kept track of the first flowering of the cherry trees in Kyoto, Japan. And I think that's coming up on close to a century of data now. There's some records from the United Kingdom that are close to a couple hundred years old. Here in North America, one of the earlier studies of phenology was one started by Aldo Leopold. And so anybody who read Sand County Almanac in high school may have had a little bit of familiarity with his interest in nature and the fact that he recorded his observations about nature. More recently, phenology has attracted attention in the context of climate change. When I started working at the Rocky Mountain Biological Laboratory in this particular project in 1973, I'm not sure I'd heard the word phenology before that, and certainly we hadn't started talking about climate change back in the 1970s. But it turns out fortuitously that by having started that study, I've recorded information about flowering, both the phenology, the timing of flowering, and the abundance of flowering for about 120 species since 1973. And it's a valuable record now because we can look to see what are the beginning effects of the changing climate. How is flowering changing? And I think maybe one of the things that listeners have already been able to pick up on is the fact that it's not a very complicated science, that you don't need a lot of high-tech equipment to get started in this field.
No Large Hadron Collider to study phenology.
Nope. When I started my work in 1973, there were no microcomputers. There were no spreadsheets. And so we just recorded all the data on paper with pencils. And over the years, as spreadsheets became available and microcomputers became available and affordable, we began to collect data and transfer data and store data in those electronic formats. It is possible now to use some pretty high-tech equipment. Maybe Jake can elaborate on that, but you can use satellite sensors now to record things like the greening up of the continents or the world in spring.
Yeah. Jake, do you guys use those kind of newer tools, I guess, that are available that weren't available to scientists in the 1970s?
Yeah, that's a great question. There's a variety of different ways that one can track plant and animal activity. You know, you can use your eyes, basically, and that's what Aldo Leopold did, and that's what Lewis and Clark did, and that's what David Inouye has been doing for years up at Rocky Mountain Biological Lab, tracking that. But also we can use more sophisticated technology that's now available. One tool that one can use, as David was mentioning, with satellites. And we have satellites that are basically orbiting the Earth, and they have what we call sensors on them, and they're picking up reflected energy coming off of the surface of the Earth or emitted energy. And we can, you know, use a couple of simple algorithms and convert that into sort of a measure of greenness. But the size of the footprint, if you will, that's being viewed by the satellite is, it depends on the satellite and the system, but it can be a kilometer by a kilometer, or, you know, almost a half mile by half mile. It's a huge area, and you can't distinguish individual plants or animals within that large, what we call a pixel. You can also get some more sophisticated imagery that has a 30 meter by 30 meter pixel. And again, it's still hard. You know, you might see a very large oak tree, but that's a lot of pixels across the whole United States, and so it takes a lot of processing. There's also cameras that are ground-based. And if you there's a new network called the PhenoCam network that allows you to place cameras out in fixed locations, and it takes images once an hour or whatever you set it to the time, and you can extract the imagery and come up with estimates of patterns of phenology at relatively local scales. So you could look at the canopy of a tree or the understory of a tree, or you could look for deer that move across the viewfinder of your PhenoCam.
Wow. It's really interesting to see all of those things, but one of the focuses of IC Change is not only looking at what is happening out in nature, but what it means. Why, without, I'll be a little rhetorical, I'm not insulting your guys' life work or anything, but why study when the flowers come up? Maybe you learn that, you know, flowers are blooming a week earlier. What does that mean? I guess we get to enjoy flowers a week earlier?
Yeah, it does mean that we're getting to enjoy, for instance, this year here in the North Fork Valley, my apricot trees are in full bloom, which causes me a little bit worry when the forecast is for 23 degrees at night. But in the broader context, there are many plants and animals that depend upon these floral resources. So in addition to seeing honeybees on my apricot trees this week, I've also seen a number of solitary bees that are native bees that have come out of winter, what we might call it hibernation. And I've also seen a couple of early queen bumblebees. And so all of these animals that interact with these flowers as pollinators, or later on that interact with the results of those flowers by consuming fruits or seeds, they have to synchronize their life cycles appropriately with those resources, or they risk being mismatched. And either, let's say, when these migratory hummingbirds start to arrive next month, what happens if they get here and they find that the early blooms that they've always depended upon are already finished? Or what happens when the bumblebee queens are coming out now, that they're not finding any flowers to feed on because they're up too early? So there is this potential for a mismatch in the seasonal timing, and that's been great cause for a number of scientists.
Wouldn't the same triggers that tell flowers to start waking up tell bumblebees and tell hummingbirds and all that, and everyone would just shift together?
Well, think about those hummingbirds. They're now down in Mexico, or maybe some of them are now in Arizona. So they have this couple of thousand mile migration to make. And what happens if the cues that they use for starting their migration in Mexico or even as far south as Guatemala are not appropriate for what's now happening further north in the United States? So in some cases, there are local cues, but bumblebees underground may not always respond in the same way as flowers do to those changing temperature cues. So there, even locally, there is that potential for mismatch. And we do have a scientist colleague from the University of Toronto who comes to Colorado every summer to study ecology. And he's found that the early flowering glacier lilies, which we're not seeing in bloom yet here, but it won't be too much longer, are now coming out before apparently the bumblebee queens emerge from hibernation. And so those earliest blooming glacier lilies are not getting pollinated.
We actually have a question from one of our DJs, actually, Donna.
Well, I have a lot of, several different fruit trees in my garden, but right now the three apricot trees are in the process of blooming. And what I noticed is that there aren't very many bees. And so I just wondered about the impact of, you know, it just seems like they're not timed together, the bees coming out and the fruit tree blossoming.
So, yeah, kind of almost exactly what we were talking about. Is that what's happening outside right now? Is what's the big danger from that?
Well, I guess the biggest danger is that there aren't going to be pollinators out at the right time, and those apricot flowers won't get pollinated unless you go out there with a paintbrush and do it yourself, and therefore you won't have any apricots. So I was very curious when my apricot trees started flowering about, a week or 10 days ago, to see if there were any pollinators. And I was pleased that it was warm enough that there were some honeybees flying. I'm not quite sure where they came from because I don't know where the nearest honeybee hives are. But somebody within a mile or two of my trees must have bees. And it was warm enough that they were out looking and found my tree. And then I was also pleased to see that there were some of the native bees that were already out and were visiting these flowers. So it's going to vary on your own backyard, depending on how close you are to either somebody else's honeybees or your own honeybees, or how close you are to where some of the native solitary bees or bumblebees, when they come out, where they're located. If you have good nesting habitat on your property for these native bees, they'll be there. And they start coming out when it starts to warm up. And so there are some things you can do to encourage native bee populations. You could look, for instance, at the website for the North American Pollinator Protection Campaign. They would give you some ideas about what you can do to encourage native bees on your property. And that's one way to make sure that when your flowers do start, even if they're early flowers like apricots, that there'll be some appropriate pollinators around.
Right, because the bees that are pretty much right next to those trees are hopefully feeling the same things that the trees
right.
are and more or less in sync, although they might not be with everything else around
right.
them.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe I can give another quick example of that. So I've got a friend who's a resource manager down here in Pima County, which is outside of basically the area around Tucson, Arizona. And he sent in a picture just the other day indicating that he had seen the ocotillo in bloom. And these are funny-looking, basically spiny stalks with beautiful clusters of red flowers, reddish-orange flowers on the top. And he was very concerned because he hadn't seen any hummingbirds yet. So the ocotillo is several weeks early, and there are no hummingbirds. So, David, it's possible, I can't really vouch for this, but it's possible that the hummingbirds are still in Mexico or still working their way up, or maybe they weren't there on this particular day. But that is an issue in the natural world where we may not have the proper pollinators there at the right time of year.
Yeah, there was actually a post on IC Change a little while ago from New Orleans. Someone had their loquat, a mm-hmm. Japanese plum tree, am I pronouncing that right?
Mm-hmm.
That they were harvesting like a month and a half early mm. that they normally do.
Mm.
So, yeah, it's not just here in the North Fork that some of these plants might be blooming a little early. But that tree was able to, I guess, produce fruit, was able to pollinate. Hopefully that happens out here in Colorado. This area is very dependent on fruit. What could a change like this mean? Would another pollinator step in?
There are a lot of managed pollinators, a lot of honeybee colonies in the North Fork Valley. Driving up and down the highway, I see somebody's white and orange hives. I don't know yet which beekeeper that is, but that beekeeper has quite a few hives in the valley. And there is quite a bit of good habitat for the native bees in this area, too. I see quite a few hedgerows, quite a few areas at the edges of orchards that are not plowed and therefore would allow ground nesting bees. Consciously or unconsciously, a number of the farmers in the North Fork Valley are already providing one of the most important resources for supporting and encouraging native pollinator populations, and that's the right habitat and the right plants, making sure that they're flowering plants season-long to support those pollinators.
Hmm. Well, I guess we can shift gears a little bit. We have another question. This one is from perennial, pardon the pun, IC Change poster Amber Kleinman. It almost seems like warming isn't warming fairly. I'll let her explain.
We have seen this pattern of late winter warm-up bringing the fruit trees to life, but our last freeze dates in the spring have stayed relatively the same. Here it's May 24th. Doesn't it seem like our last freeze date would start to creep earlier in the year? It's like the days are getting warmer, but the nights keep staying just as cold.
David, have you ever seen anything like that in your research?
I have, actually, something just like that. So one of the flowers that I study a lot is a plant called the aspen sunflower, Heliandella quincunervis is its scientific name. One of the things I've been doing with that is counting the number of flowers in a couple of plots every year, and I've done that since sometime in the mid to late 70s. And one of the things I noticed was that it used to be that there would be every few years, maybe every 4 or 5 years, a year with very few flowers. And then the next year, there'd be thousands and thousands of flowers again. And it turns out that this is a wildflower that's sensitive to frost. And what I was seeing was the consequences of years with early snowmelt, which starts the growing season early. But our last frost date up there is about the 10th of June. And so if you have a normal or late snowmelt, the plants haven't developed very far by the 10th of June. If the snow melts, as it sometimes does now in mid-April or mid to late April, then by the 10th of June, these plants have developed quite a bit and have buds which then get killed by frost. So what we're seeing here in the North Fork Valley with early flowering apricot trees and frost is exactly what's happening to some of the sunflowers and some of the other wildflowers up at 9,500 feet. So it is true that the nights have been warming up more in temperature than daytime temperatures have been. And that's probably one thing that helps to trigger these early flowering fruit trees like apricots into coming into bloom now in March. But it's not quite as clear why the frost dates have not changed as much yet. It could be in part because of the increased variability in temperature that's been predicted by a number of climate models. So maybe even though temperatures are getting warmer, the extremes are increasing, and that's why we're still having hard frosts in the 10th of June.
So the general trend is kind of an upward warming, but at the same time,
the variability,
the extremes, if it's going back and forth, it's still low enough to dip into that freezing when it really hurts.
Right.
Yep. Yeah. There's a good example from the Midwest again. In 2012, it was a very early spring, and all the apple trees put on their flowers sort of in response to that early warm spring. And as it turns out, there was a frost. It was what we call a false spring. There was a strong frost that basically killed huge numbers of apple blossoms. They just can't stand that cold weather. And the entire industry in that region lost millions of dollars of production that year. And so that is one, as we've been talking about, that's one of the worries about an early spring, what we call a false spring, that can have, you know, essentially huge susceptibilities to frosts.
Jake, we had a local here in Colorado example of that too last year, where we had an unusual warm spell in spring. And then I forget the date now, but any of the growers around here could tell you exactly which date it was in April, which caused the loss of not only the apricots that last year, but also almost all the apples, almost all the peaches, almost all the pears. And so it was a major loss, a major blow to the growers here. And that year that you mentioned, 2012, I remember reading that in Michigan, all of the all the cherry festivals, which they typically have in Michigan, they had to import cherries from Washington State because there were no cherries that year in Michigan.
Yep. And the cherry blossoms is another example where around the tidal basin and in the Baltimore and Washington D.C. area, you know, there's a sort of human migration, if you will, out there at this time of year to attend the Blossom Festival. And it's always been really interesting to watch what might happen if you have cherry blossoms that come on because of warm conditions and if you have a cold freeze. And so they did face that just about a week ago. There were pictures of, you know, snow and cold rain weather on emerged blossoms or some of the earlier blossoms. Not much damage, but again, that's a huge multi-million-dollar tourist industry all around the cherry blossoms in the D.C. area.
Yeah, I guess it's not just an agricultural issue for early blossoms being killed by frost.
Yeah, it's a human cultural issue.
Looking at this happening last spring, as David mentioned, it was pretty devastating around here, that frost that came through. And talking to orchardists, they're roughly not happy about it, but there seemed to be, well, you know, that's this area. It's always been risky growing fruit out here in Colorado. Some years are great and some years are not. With this happening, is there a chance that this could happen more and more often?
I think there is. I mean, I was talking with one of the workmen who was helping do some work on my house this fall, and his father was in this area and had an orchard. And my recollection is that this plumber told me that his father said that from the 1930s up until 1970, he lost, when he stopped his work as an orchardist, there were only 2 years, I think, when he lost his crop due to frost. And now it seems like it's every second or third year that there are problems here. So I think the frequency has been increasing. Hopefully it's not going to get any more frequent than it's already been.
Yeah, Jake, you were talking about how a freeze wiped out millions of dollars of production out in the Midwest. I imagine no one just kind of like shrugged that off. What is the plan for agriculture as a way to support human development and life if the plants that we depend on for our food and other things can't make it through the spring?
Yeah, I think maybe the watchword here might be adaptation. How do we adapt to changing and increasingly variable environmental conditions, that is climate or anything else in our environment? And so if human beings can adapt to that, then we'll be okay. And I think farmers, I often say farmers do phenology. You know, farmers are totally tuned in to climatological variation, meteorological variation and are constantly adapting and adjusting the kinds of crops that they are planting, maybe shifting to a shorter day type of plant, or maybe shifting to something that's more drought tolerant, or maybe even shifting species, or maybe thinking about, okay, well, where would I expand my operation? Do I want to go downslope where it's potentially warmer and drier? Do I want to move upslope or further north?
Well, one other adaptation I've thought about is that the apricot tree I have on my property is an old one, and I tried to put a tarp over it the other night when it was getting cold, and it's just too tall. And so I think if I put in some new trees, I'm going to have to prune them so that they're small enough, short enough, that I'll be able to cover them if I want to try and protect them from frosts in the future. And I don't know a lot about plant breeding, but I would be surprised if there aren't plant breeders thinking about things like, how do we select for, let's say, apricot trees that don't flower so early, or how do we select for apple trees that don't require quite as many 100 hours of below freezing temperatures in order to make sure that they're going to flower.
You guys are either killing it with the segues, or Amber Kleiman is like prescient and knows exactly what we're talking about, because she had a question just about this.
In addition, will fruit trees adapt to this pattern over time, or will this early season warming trick them into budding early every year?
This is not the only climate change our planet's ever gone through. Life has survived. It changes. It adapts. Mm-hmm. What about the trees? What about the crops that we have?
Well, the individual trees have a little bit of plasticity in terms of when they come into bloom and how they respond to these the changing climate. But you're right. There is a genetic component, and therefore the plants can't change their genes, but plant breeders can. And so they can select for traits that are going to be more favorable with the future climate. And I think growers here in the North Fork Valley will have to keep track of, well, what are the options that plant breeders are making available in the future for best ways to adapt to that changing climate.
And there is a lot of variation out there. I mean, if you walk around out there in the North Fork Valley or go up to Silverton, you'll see that some plants are starting to get rolling for the year. You know, little buds are starting to break. Maybe some flowers are coming on, and others are not. And actually, it varies from one species to the next in terms of their sensitivity. So we see that some plants typically are very early when it's warm, whereas others are kind of more, recalcitrant, you know. But as it turns out, there can be some really strong relationships between organisms that are sort of flexible or elastic in their phenology versus others that aren't. And that's kind of a million-dollar question for the natural world. Because if you have a plant that can respond to conditions and be sensitive to the changes, but still maybe not affected by frost, then you might be able to get a leg up. Because why are these plants coming out early? The reason is for them to capture carbon, take up carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, and start to grow and get a head start before other things grow during the year as well. So there's sort of a bit of a race here, but you then end up maybe leaving yourself more susceptible. So if we can figure out which are the organisms that are more plastic or elastic in their responses, maybe those are the ones we don't need to worry about so much, or maybe they are. So we're trying to understand how plants and animals vary in their responses to climate across space and through time, and then we can figure out where do we prioritize in terms of our conservation efforts.
My final question for you two, kind of along those lines, and we've talked a lot about fruit trees and agriculture, and that is very important, that agriculture, that money, but also wildflowers and hummingbirds and things like that. Knowing what you know about what's happening and what will and can happen in the future, are you guys afraid? How do you feel about not only our immediate livelihoods and things like that, but the natural world as we know it?
Oh, I guess it turns out coincidentally that this has been a very interesting time in my to be spending my scientific career studying things about the changing environment and how it's responding in terms of phenology, for instance. So in that way, it's been a lot of fun, or it's still a lot of fun. I'm old enough to have grandkids, and I do worry about the future world that we're leaving to my grandkids and everybody else's children and their grandchildren and so on. Fortunately, our species is very good at adapting And so I don't fear, as some of my colleagues do, so much for the future of our species, but I think the world that my grandkids are growing up in and that their children will have to deal with is going to be a very different world from the one that I grew up in.
Yeah, I think information is really, you know, our friend. So we need as much information as we can, collected in an efficient manner, to determine which are the organisms or systems that are most vulnerable to environmental change. And if we know what those are, then we can maybe do things to try to mitigate the impact. So some systems might be very sensitive to, say, drought. Well, maybe there are ways that we can help to, you know, prevent the impact of drought on these organisms by, say, trying to manage invasive species that take up a lot of early spring soil moisture. Or if we are wanting to continue to go skiing and have nice long skiing seasons, we should be maybe thinking about dust production of dust off of damaged rangelands that blows across on the Colorado snowpack and causes earlier and faster snowmelt. And those are culturally important activities. We really enjoy the opportunity to go out and spend time outdoors, and we also really enjoy the goods and services that we call ecosystem services that we get from nature, clean water and clean air. And we really need to think about how do we live sort of in harmony and understand our natural systems and do what we can to protect them because they're protecting us.
Armed with the information, are you hopeful that we'll be able to leverage that successfully?
Yeah, I think we can. So one of the things we're working on here at the National Phenology Network is development of what we call national scale products, data products, that basically takes the information that we're collecting from our observers who are part of Nature's Notebook, and we turn that back around into information that can be used by natural resource managers, like at a national park or a national wildlife refuge, who can then use that information to make decisions about, okay, how do I manage my system? Where should I be conserving my system? Where should I be putting my scarce resources? Where should I be buying my next plot? So I feel like if we can take these data products and turn them into kind of more real-time forecasts of what is happening, we can actually kind of create notification systems to different stakeholders and say, hey, look, you've got this early spring, but there's this danger of frost, that and get the word out, and so people can take advantage of that. So it's not just the raw data that we need, but more kind of the accumulation and the aggregation of that information, and then turning it back around to different users and different stakeholders who have different kinds of applications, like managing invasive plants or providing for waterfowl, or, you know, working to figure out where do I move my livestock from one pasture to the next and when do I move them up the slope. So those are all important decisions we make in our natural world.
Definitely. Well, David, Jake, thank you very much both for your time. It was a pleasure talking with you.
You're welcome. It was fun.
Thank you very much.
That was David Inouye and Jake Wiltzien. If you've got questions about phenology in your area, if you're noticing things seem shifted, let us know over at icchange.org. You can post pictures, ask questions, and we'll get to the bottom of it. You've been listening to Local Motion for KVNF. I'm Jake Ryan.